My next guest has really done a bang-up job with this book and uncovered some very explosive information. Now, he's been with us in the past discussing secret Nazi activity as it relates to advanced propulsion technology, etc. But he's going to delve a little deeper tonight into their post-war activities. Joseph Farrell, as I say, has been with us before. He's an Oxford-educated historian. And now in his new book, Nazi International, The Nazis' Post-War Plan to Control Finance, Conflict, Physics, and Space, he exposes secret Nazi activity and how the Nazis survived World War II and engaged in post-war manipulation of various manufacturing technologies, economies, and whole countries. Joseph Farrell, welcome once again, my friend, to News Talk 1010 CFRB.
Hi, Richard. How are you doing tonight?
Very well, thank you. So, let me ask you, first of all, about the Nazi surrender at the end of the Second World War, because that's kind of strange, the way that that was done.
Right, right. Well, the strangest thing about it, Richard, is that there are actually two surrenders. There's a surrender to the Western Allies at Reims, France, that is signed by Colonel General Alfred Jodl, who was the chief of the staff of the High Command, German High Command. There is a second one on May 8th, a day later, which is signed in Berlin, largely at the behest of the Soviets, who wanted higher representatives present. And all three service branches of the German military are present. But what is really unusual, and I print both of the surrenders in the first chapter of the book along with the Japanese surrender just so people can kind of compare, because strangely enough, the people surrendering in the European theater are not representatives of the German government. In other words, you know, they're signing on behalf of the German military for the German high command, even though that high command at the time is under the command of Grand Admiral Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler. But you don't have anyone signing officially for the Reich government. And what's more important to me, I think, in respect of what we're going to talk about tonight, is that we don't have anyone signing for the Nazi Party. There's no representative at all of the Reich. There's no representative at all of the Nazi Party.
In other words, the German military surrendered
right.
in 1945,
right.
but not the German government, not the Nazi Party, none of its officials.
None of its officials,
well,
right.
Well, contrast now, that to the Japanese surrender.
Well, the Japanese surrender, you know, everybody is surrendering that should be surrendering. The emperor has a representative, the imperial cabinet, the imperial diet, the imperial Japanese general staff. In other words, everybody that should be surrendering is. So, you know, you contrast that to the German surrender. Now, I should point out there is a little general codicil in both surrenders that say that these surrender terms will be set aside in any general surrender terms to be worked out at a later date. But the trouble is I can't find them. You know, they may be part of treaties that we subsequently signed with West Germany, and that may very well be. But again, and if that's the case, you have no representative of the Reich government, and you have no representative of the Nazi Party. You know, you'd think that the Allies and the Russians, who just spent, you know, 50 to 75 million casualties and limitless amounts of their national treasuries to defeat this war machine, you would think that they would demand a member of the Nazi Party to be present to surrender and abolish the Nazi Party legally. So, you know.
Yes, one would think, Joseph Farrell, author of Nazi International, The Nazis' Post-War Plan to Control Finance, Conflict, Physics, and Space. Of course, he's been with us before, the author of Reich of the Black Sun, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, Secrets of the Unified Field. He was with us most recently to discuss that. And through all of your work, really, there is that underlying theme that the Nazis survived the Second World War. They
yeah.
were not eradicated, and formed partnerships, corporate partnerships in the United States. They basically moved their base of operation. But let's just go back to the surrender for a moment.
Sure.
After Hitler's supposed suicide, who held power? with the Nazis. Was there a successor?
Well, there's two people. Legally, the successor to Hitler as Reich president is Grand Admiral Dönitz. And then he appoints Joseph Goebbels as his infamous propaganda minister as chancellor, which is a peculiar arrangement since Hitler had combined both offices upon the death of President Hindenburg in the early 1930s. So he splits the offices again, but it's very clear that he intends Admiral Dönitz to be the head of state and the actual wielder of power. But there's another power behind the throne, and he's probably a name that's going to loom very significant in our conversations tonight, and that's Martin Bormann, who, of course, at that time is the actual head of the Nazi Party, and who, in my opinion, you know, I think escaped Nazi Germany along with some other significant people. So, you know, there's no one really to represent the Nazi Party, and maybe that's why the Allies didn't ask for anybody, because they knew he was long gone.
Or perhaps this was done by design. Who knows? Joseph Farrell, stay with us. We'll come back and continue to discuss the Nazis' post-war plans here on The Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010 CFRB.
The Richard Serrett Show continues on News Talk 1010 CFRB.
Joseph P. Farrell is with us in his new book, Nazi International. He uncovers the Nazis' hand in the development and control of new energy technologies, and says that the Nazi power base was not eradicated in World War II. Now, Joseph, back we were talking about the odd instrument of surrender of the Germans, the fact that the military surrendered, but no Nazi Party officials surrendered.
Right.
No, the government, in fact, did not surrender. And I'm wondering if this might have anything to do with... Well, I know that you cite Anthony Sutton's work in your book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. The idea here that Wall Street was involved in the financing of, well, first helping Hitler come to power and then financing the war effort.
Right.
And we were all familiar with Prescott Bush, you know, being charged with trading under the Enemy Act and
right.
His involvement with, was it Fitz Tyson,
right.
Hitler's financier. Does that have anything to do with it, the fact that the Wall Street, the elite, wanted to preserve they didn't want to surrender because they were partners with the Nazis?
Well, I don't think so much directly, but I think there is an indirect connection, and it's a very odd one and a very infamous one once you get into it. If you all recall the firm of IG Farben, you know, this gigantically huge German chemicals cartel.
Bayer
and Hoechst and
yes.
Merck, and you know, it's just about everybody you can think of was part of this thing in some way, shape, or form. Well, IG Farben really is kind of Nazi Germany's industrial complex. I mean, that one corporation accounted for almost at least 50%, and in many more cases, specific instances, almost 100% of Nazi Germany's war production in some shape or form.
And their headquarters were purposely not destroyed by the Allied bombers.
Right. And, well, Farben, you know, kind of comes into existence with Wall Street help. But there's one very interesting thing, and it's this very signal lesson, I think, for history. The Germans do not play ball with Wall Street. They go their own way, and we see what happens with Farben. We see an international company, a truly international company, but it's always cemented around a solidly German core, and this is the model, really, that Bormann and his henchmen follow in setting up the Nazi strategic evacuation plan. In effect, what they really do is they internationalize Nazism. In other words, it's no longer a national socialism per se. But it's always around this solidly German core with loyal Nazis in key positions. And one of the interesting things I uncover is a meeting that was held in Strasbourg, France in August of 1944, in which he outlines this evacuation plan. And very briefly, what he does is he more or less confiscates the cash reserves of big German corporations and then turns around and gives them back to these corporations with the understanding that they're going to set up these research bureaus all over the world, and in each case, they're going to be staffed with a Nazi Party liaison officer. So he's signaling, several intentions here, Richard, and I think they're very important to spell them out very explicitly what they are. He's signaling, first of all, the Nazi Party's intention to continue exotic research. That's number one. Secondly, he's signaling his intention to use corporate fronts for espionage against, his former enemies, basically. And the most significant thing is that Bormann himself intends to survive the war to coordinate all of this activity. So, by just one account, if we look at what Bormann has at his disposal in Argentina alone after the end of the war, he has an $800 million cash reserve in 1945 dollars in various currencies that are available to him and, incidentally, Juan Perón in joint bank accounts. He's got 95 tons of gold, any number of kilograms of diamonds and platinum and so on and so forth, and this is just Argentina. So the point is that the Allied claims to have rolled up this Nazi strategic evacuation plan really, I think, is kind of smoke and mirrors, because after all, who are they using to investigate all of this? Well, they're using what will eventually become the American CIA, and of course, we already know the history there.
Sure, they recruited
the
German top intelligence. was it Reinhard Galen?
Reinhard Galen, yes. Right. So, we've got Nazis looking for Nazis. So, in other words, the way I look at it is it's more than likely that anything we did find, we found because Bormann wanted us to find it. And there's much of this story that's so hidden that, has only come to light really since German reunification that, again, it looks to me that you have the creation, really, of what I call the book, a Nazi International, that basically has taken the party underground, but it's pursuing all of its old agendas and all of its old research projects and using this vast amount of money that they've spirited out of Europe to do it with.
Albeit in far more sophisticated terms, no more brown shirts and Kristallnacht. They're subtle. Their means are far more subtle. Listen, we'll take a quick time out, come back. News awaits at the bottom of the hour. Back on the other side with Joseph P. Farrell, author of Nazi International. We'll talk about Operation Paperclip and the Nazification of America. Back with more of the Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010 CFRB. Historian, researcher Joseph P. Farrell with us. His new one is Nazi International, the Nazis' post-war plan to control, finance, conflict, physics, and space. Now, let's talk a little bit about Operation Paperclip.
Sure.
Some of the prominent Nazis that found their way into the United States, of course, Wernher von Braun is well known, and his work with NASA.
Right.
What about some of the other ones? I have heard that although we were told that Mengele washed ashore somewhere in Argentina in the mid 70s, that at some point he was in fact working on the west coast of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Any truth to that?
Well, I haven't heard that, but there are a number of things about Mengele that are very interesting that might corroborate that. I do know that at a certain point in his post-war life, he did make his way to Mexico to coordinate activities with family members there who did have business interests in the United States. And there is a great deal of evidence. I don't get into it in this particular book because my focus, again, is largely the physics. But there is evidence, Richard, to suggest that the Nazis, particularly centering around, that infamous Colonia Dignidad in Chile, were involved in some sort of continued medical experimentation, because there were just all sorts of children that were abducted and just horrible things done to them from all over Europe and Latin America and taken to this compound. So there is this suggestion that there's an ongoing medical aspect of this wartime research that was continued after the war. And, of course, Mengele would be one of the logical choices for them to have in charge of something like that. So, the activities in Latin America of this Nazi International are just, I spend two whole chapters on just the physics in it. It's just really breathtaking once you stop and consider what's going on, because, again, it implies this enormous organization that has a great deal of security, that has a great deal of financing and penetration into the corporate world. So, paperclip in this country and the similar equivalents in Great Britain and Canada and France those are kind of the tip of the iceberg, because, you know, we have to remember that if you grant the fact that Borman and some of his key henchmen, I call them the unholy trinity, because I believe that Borman and Heinrich Miller, the actual head of the Gestapo, and then this SS general that I've written about in so many of the other books, that headed up the Third Reich's secret weapons research projects, General Hans Kammler, I believe all three made it out of Nazi Germany. So look what you have. You have a mastermind, just a really brilliant man when it comes to finances, namely Bormann. You have the head of Gestapo counterintelligence security, namely Heinrich Miller. And then you have a man that's, you know, accustomed to leading and administrating large covert secret research projects, all getting out. So, you know, that tells the story right there. This is a tremendously organized effort on their part.
Absolutely. We had people like Kurt Blohm, who was charged with euthanasia in the Nuremberg trials,
yes,
and human experimentation, ends up being acquitted, exfiltrated into the United States through Operation Paperclip, and,
right,
and ends up working for the U.S. Army Chemical Corps to,
yes,
work on chemical warfare.
Well, I'll go you one better. If you recall something I wrote in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, one of the most significant scientists, the man that actually designed the power plant for the Bell, a fellow by the name of Dr. Kurt Davis, ends up a paperclip scientist and ends up being the flight director during the Apollo mission programs at Cape Canaveral. So in other words, you know, you have this high-ranking Nazi that was involved in some very secret research, and he's not even a rocket scientist. So what's he doing heading up Apollo? And better than that, I discovered that Dr. Hubertus Strughold, and I mentioned this in this new book, I've discovered that he was involved in the medical aspects of the Bell research project. Well, he, of course, ends up, for a period of time, heading up space medicine for NASA. So, you know, we have all of these big Nazis, and, you know, as Richard Hoagland has pointed out in his book, Dark Mission, it looks as if by the time that Apollo is really up and running, that the Nazis have more or less gained a significant amount of influence in that program, such that they can land Apollo missions, you know, on April 20th, which is Adolf Hitler's birthday. And there's even kind of a ritual alignment that I think Mr. Hoagland may have inadvertently have missed, because when Apollo 11 lands on the moon, it does so on July 20th, 1969.
Right.
Well, that is the 25th anniversary of the bomb plot, the coup attempt against Hitler that was unsuccessful in 1944. So again, you see, there's all these little indicators that you have from around the world that this Nazi International is alive and well, and, you know, we're just kind of scratching the surface. We've got big projects in Argentina. We've got a big project going on in the early stages of Gamal Abdel Nasser's Egypt, you know, so there's just all sorts of activity going on, and it's all coordinated.
All right, we'll take another time out. Joseph Farrell stays with us. We'll get to your phone calls as well. Joseph Farrell stays with us, author of Nazi International, The Nazis' Post-War Plan to Control Finance, Conflict, Physics, and Space. He says that the Nazi power base was not eradicated in the Second World War. And the publisher is it Adventures Unlimited?
Yes, it is.
Of course. Who else? Who else but our good friends at Adventures Unlimited? All right, let's grab a call here while we can.
Sure.
Jeremy is in Toronto. Good evening. Welcome to News Talk 1010. Jeremy, you're on the line with Joseph Farrell.
Oh, hi, Mr. Farrell.
Hi.
I wanted to try to tie this into the present, what you're saying about the Nazi non-surrender. Do you believe maybe that the Nazi movement is working through governments, for instance, like Liberals, NDP, Green parties? Do you believe that maybe that the Nazis are working through these types of governments, and very subtly, but in a more subtle fashion, to basically manipulate people and basically turn people into non-liberated individuals?
Well, that's a very timely question, Jeremy. I can't speak to particular political parties other than there is a known connection between neo-Nazism and various Green parties in Europe. I certainly wouldn't know what the conditions are in Canada with the Liberal Party and so on and so forth. But let me say this. there are indicators that in the post-war period there was a sort of quiet détente between the Anglo-American corporate elite and this Nazi international. And the reason I say that is that the founder of the Bilderberger Group, which was Prince Bernhard, of course, of the Netherlands, what most people don't know about him was that he was an SS officer and that he was a vice president of IG Farben. So it looks to me like the group may have been set up both to liaise with that Anglo-American corporate elite as well as to kind of keep an eye on it. But my personal opinion is that there may be some factional infighting going on right now in that globalist corporate elite crowd, and that some of it may be going or coming from, I should say, from this Nazi international. So yes, briefly in answer to your question, I do think that they're still active. I do think that they're still organized. And if you want the proof of the pudding in that, just get my book and read the chapter on German reunification. It will really blow your mind.
All right, Jeremy, thanks for that. Well, let's dial it back to November 22nd, 1963. We just passed the 45th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, and many researchers look at that event as a coup d'etat.
Right.
We obviously at that point there were a number of prominent Nazis in the United States. I don't know to what extent someone like a Fritz Kramer in the Pentagon, what kind of power he had, although it is suggested that he was the one that told Reagan to visit the Bitburg Cemetery and lay a wreath at the tomb of an SS soldier.
Right.
And whether that was a way of sort of wink-wink, nudge-nudge, showing
right.
the world who was really running things. But
right.
do you think that some of the prominent Nazis or members of the Nazi International that were in the United States were in fact behind the coup d'etat?
Well, let me put it this way. The short answer to that, the Cliff Notes version, is an emphatic yes. I go into this a bit in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, and if you read all of the Nazi-related books very carefully, what I'm suggesting is that when we take over, when the United States takes over the German military intelligence in Eastern Europe and on the Eastern Front under General Galen, and for all intents and purposes makes that the day-to-day operative Soviet desk of the CIA, that when Kennedy comes along and does two significant things, when he threatens to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces.
Yes.
And secondly, as Mr. Hoagland has uncovered in Dark Mission, when he decides that he's going to try and go to the moon with the Soviet Union, that this threatens two of the significant power bases and fiefdoms of that Nazi international inside this country. You know, and one of the things that's very significant, Richard, is most people don't know this, but District Attorney Garrison down in New Orleans uncovered many of these Nazi connections in his investigation. But neither he nor even Oliver Stone really knew what to make of them. You know, what are they doing there hovering on the fringes of the Kennedy assassination? As far as President Reagan goes, if you go back to literature that was put out by the Democratic National Committee and some of their researchers in the period, I'd say from 1984 up to President George Herbert Walker Bush and his bid for the presidency, they put out a number of very good and thoroughly researched things pointing out that many of the emigre exilee communities, you know, Bielorussians and Latvians and Lithuanians and so on, that were contributing so heavily to President Bush's campaign at that time, were in fact front organizations that had been set up. In other words, the historical pedigree of these things dated back to the war and to General Galen's military intelligence operations on the Eastern Front. So, you know, there you go.
Well, it's interesting that a lot of the characters associated with the Kennedy assassination were white Russians.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the most significant of them all being George de Morenschild, you know, and if you read long and hard enough, you'll discover that he was suspected as being a Nazi spy. So, you know, this thing is very, very deep, and there's no doubt in my mind that they are continual and active to this day. And again, you know, for your caller and your listeners, the proof is in the pudding. If you want to read some really scary stuff, just read the chapter in the new book about German reunification.
All right, let's come back and touch on a little bit about the Nazi International's involvement in an activity in alternative energy.
Okay.
Back with more of the Richard Serrett Show, along with Joseph Farrell, author of Nancy International. Stay with us here on News Talk 1010 CFRB. We are running up against news at the top of the hour, but Joseph Farrell will stay with us until 11:30, the author of Nancy International, The Nazis' Post-War Plan to Control Finance, Conflict, Physics, and Space. And he says the Nazi power base was not eradicated in World War II. We'll hold off and we'll discuss the controlled fusion experiments in Argentina until after the news. So we just have time, I think, to work in a call, and we'll say hello to Paul in Whitby. Welcome to News Talk 1010, Paul.
Thanks for taking the call, Richard. Hi, Joseph. How are you tonight?
Hey, Paul. How are you? I'm doing good, pretty good.
Very, very interesting. I've looked at history back with the Germans in the 30s, and of course where we are today of ultimate control being Aryan descent. And in the 30s, I've read, and I've even spoken to an elderly German person, that apparently there was a relationship with a type of species of gray that were extraterrestrial, that there was a crash in the Bavarian Mountains in the Czech side in the 33. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I have heard these persisting rumors of Nazi crash and retrieval of UFOs for many, many years, and I have investigated them. I never talk about them in my books, and the reason being is I've never found any good, solid evidence that would lead me to that opinion. I think you can rationalize most of the exotic physics, as I do in all four of the books, that they were investigating prior to and during the war on the basis of known physics principles and papers that were published in Germany or other countries in Europe. Excuse me. So I don't think you need to go there. Again, the evidence just isn't there. Now, interestingly enough, in Reich of the Black Sun, I do talk about a secret UFO study group that Mussolini established as early as 1929. So there may be something going on in fascist Italy that we don't know about yet because we haven't found all the documents. But as far as the Nazis go, I hate to disappoint you, but I haven't heard anything about it.
All right, Paul in Whitby, thanks for the call. News is next, back on the other side, talking about Nazi International with Joseph Farrell, Adventures Unlimited Press, the publisher. Back with more. Stay with us on News Talk 1010 CFRB. Anyway, we'll pick things up now with Joseph P. Farrell, author of Nazi International, The Nazis' Post-War Plan to Control Finance, Conflict, Physics, and Space, Adventure Unlimited Press, the publisher. Now, the post-war Argentina, work there carried out to develop nuclear fusion power. We were talking about nuclear fusion for peaceful purposes after the war, and the Nazis were involved. There's no question about that?
Absolutely none whatsoever. Perón had started this project in 1948 with an Austrian physicist by the name of Dr. Ronald Richter. And Richter himself, I put a bunch of his documents from his paperclip file in the book because it's very important for people to see what he was actually up to. And controlled thermonuclear fusion was really the tip of the iceberg. Perón disclosed the existence of this project, Richard, in a press conference he gave in 1951. And it's very interesting because once he did so, the project was roundly denounced by all the world's major scientists and, of course, in the United States as well. But privately, behind the scenes, when I got the documents from the National Archives from his file, as late as 1956, Richard, the U.S. Air Force is expressing a deep interest in what he was doing, not only in Argentina, but in Nazi Germany as early as 1936. And if you read this documentation very carefully and consider some of the things that I point out about the project that he was actually involved with, what Richter believed was that plasma put into a state of rotation, and there's your connection to the Nazi bell, would actually be something that could not only detect but be a means of tapping into the so-called zero-point energy. So when he's roundly denounced by the world's scientists, Perón decides he's going to appoint a commission and get to the bottom of it to see whether or not he's just been ripped off by this guy. But interestingly enough, when the commission shows up at his laboratories, Richter does everything in his power, Richard, to hide his measuring equipment, not to turn it on, to put it in the wrong place so it will do absolutely no good. In other words, at every turn that he is confronted by the commission, he goes out of his way to make the project appear either fraudulent or make himself look like a fool, like a mountebank, like a swindler. So my suspicion is, and I devote two whole chapters in the book about Richter and his project, my suspicion is that given his very odd behavior that is really irrational for any scientist involved in a project like this, that he's probably following orders to shut the project down and get it out of Perron's hands and out of the world's eyes. Because after that, we really don't know what happens to this project or where it goes. It disappears completely. But there's one more thing I should add. The project took place in a remote province of Argentina, Rio Negro province, about 900 miles southwest of Buenos Aires, out in the middle of nowhere. The major town there is San Carlos de Bariloche. And as I point out in several chapters of the book, if you go to San Carlos and if you go to this province, you're going to see a lot of very peculiarly German architecture, including a major hotel, which incidentally was even built during the war as a plastic surgery clinic.
Oh my word. Isn't that interesting?
Isn't that convenient?
Yes.
And this, you know, the Nazis actually bought, Richard, about 10,000 square miles of Argentina. In other words, they bought an area almost the size of the state of Massachusetts and turned this place into what I call the post-war Nazi Vatican, because to enter and leave this compound, there were armed guards. You had to have military-style passes. It's rumored, of course, and the Argentine Central Intelligence documents themselves indicate that Bormann headquartered himself in this area at the time of Richter's fusion project. And to me, this is key because, again, it really kind of corroborates the idea that Richter is following somebody's orders to quite literally diss this project in the eyes of the world and get it shut down so that they could move it elsewhere.
Yes, because he originally reported to Perón that it was a success.
Right.
Perón announced that it was a success. And
right.
Then, as you say, these, I guess, the world came to the beating down the door, and he did everything in his power to prove or to show them that it was not a success.
Right.
And the world declared that this method of attaining fusion was unsuitable. It couldn't be done. But
right.
You're saying it was done, it was perfected, and they simply moved the base of operation elsewhere. So what are the ramifications, then, of controlled nuclear fusion being perfected by the early 50s?
Well, let's look at what Richter actually says. If you read what he himself explains 4 years later to the U.S. Air Force, which is profoundly disinterested in his work, to the point it comes up with a specific shopping list of items that he was researching in Nazi Germany to have him explain. In other words, you know, we're disinterested in you, but we want to know about these things.
Right,
know?
Right.
So what Richter was really attempting to do was he was attempting to introduce shock waves into a plasma that could sustain a thermonuclear reaction. But his real belief was that this was a key to energy that was gating in from somewhere else. In other words, Richter's already way ahead of the game. He's thinking in terms of hyperdimensional reactions inside this plasma, which connects to some of the work I've got in another book that's coming out in a couple of months. But what Richter's really doing then is he's continuing, if you examine all the details that I put in the book, he's continuing the Nazi Bell project in Argentina. So he goes out of his way, really, and he himself will tell the Americans in the documents that I reproduce in the book. He tells them that the Argentines got none of the data from the project when they shut it down, and none of his measuring equipment. So in other words, Argentina really wasn't controlling that project to begin with, and there's
right.
only one other place that can be, and that's the Nazi International. So they close the project down, and it moves somewhere else, and nobody knows where. This is the key. So the whole indicator, Richard, is that this project in alternative energy was kept deliberately suppressed by Nazis and moved elsewhere.
All right. We'll pick it up on the other side. Back in a moment with more of my conversation with Joseph P. Farrell on Nazi International. Back with more here on News Talk 1010 CFRB. All right, a few moments remain with Joseph Farrell. Nazi International, the Nazis' post-war plan to control finance, conflict, physics, and space. Do you pursue the idea that this alternative energy, this nuclear fusion, might have led to the development of some sort of particle beam weaponry?
Oh, boy. That's an excellent question. I suggested in the previous books, not so much in this one, Richard, but certainly in SS Brotherhood and Secrets of the Unified Field, and it's really an excellent question. But let's get to the bottom line. This whole association of thermonuclear fusion, the Nazi Bell, and so on, it's really a project that the Nazis were investigating in order to control gravity. And they were doing so for three different purposes. They were doing so to have a means of free energy, of field propulsion for advanced aircraft, and then finally to weaponize it. And, you know, you had Paul LaViolette on your show recently.
Yes.
And, you know, he's a really top-notch physicist with just a brilliant theory, you know, if you read it. But basically, I have to concur with him. Anytime you weaponize this type of physics, you have a very, very powerful weapon that, you know, potentially, and I've said it before many times, that potentially would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker.
Well, it's been theorized that that this type of technology could be used to create hurricanes.
Oh, yes, yeah. You can. This is a very flexible physics, Richard, and depending on how you configure it, yes, you can do weather modification. You know, there's almost limitless possibilities with it.
And the Nazi International has it. That means the elite, the unelected oligarchs, have it. And
right.
The question is, how are they using it?
Well, this is the real story. If this détente is breaking down, I think the elite has it. But the point really to make here is that this ongoing Nazi International also has it, and that's the scary part.
Are they not one and the same?
No, I don't think so. I go back to what I said before. I think that there was a kind of a post-war detente between the Anglo-American banking elite and this Nazi International, but I think it's breaking down.
Interesting. All right. Well, congratulations on this well-documented treatment. And again, available, is it Amazon.com?
It may be at Amazon. It just came out, Richard, and if they're in a hurry for it, it's best to contact the publisher directly, which is Adventures Unlimited, and the number is 1-800-718-4514 during normal business hours.
Give us that number again.
Sure, 1-800-718-4514.
All right, Joseph, always a pleasure, and
thank you.
Keep up the great work. Keep these books coming.
I certainly will, Richard. Thanks for having me back on.
All right. Thank you, my friend.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.